Hey, all, it's Dan. Will you put this on your calendar for me? On Tuesday, April 13th, Amy Yakubov and I will be on Flaviar's Nightcap Live on Zoom at 5:30 p.m. Pacific Time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and we'll be debating the ever-important question, the old-fashioned versus the Negroni, which is better. We're making both cocktails to get to the bottom of it once and for all. Members of Flaviar will be able to join via Zoom and get involved. For you non-members, check us out on Flaviar's YouTube channel or become a member and come hang out for a spirited debate. Again, Tuesday, April 13th, the old-fashioned versus the Negroni. One drink will enter and only one comes out alive.
This is Harry Lennox from the Justice League, and you are listening to A Great Injustice.
Well, pour yourself a glass, sit for a spill. It's time to have some fun. Let's do a little thinking, some picking and a drinking. Well, this is what we're drinking with Dan Dunn.
Welcome to the show. I'm Dan Dunn. We got a big one today. I hope you're thirsty. We got some fantastic liquid going down. You thirsty? You should be thirsty.
Stay thirsty, my friends.
Joining us on the program, brilliant actor by the name of Harry Lennox from The Blacklist on NBC. He's in the Justice League. He's been in everything. Harry's the best, and he's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. Also on the show, the founder of Barrel Craft Spirits. That's the man who's responsible for the aforementioned fantastic liquid we're drinking. Joe Beatrice will be joining us as well. A lot to get to, so I'm gonna hurry through. I want to tell you up front, I've got a friend named Elaine Duff, who's a 20-year industry veteran to mixologist. She's worked for, my God, name the brand, Ciroc Vodka, Tanqueray, Bullet Bourbon, Don Julio Tequila. And now Elaine has a show that she does on YouTube. It's a weekly live series called Celebrating the Brand Ambassador. There are about 15 episodes in. I've checked it out. I love it. She's interviewing people that rep beverage companies. And if you're listening to this show, I'm assuming you're into adult beverages. So she's had the global ambassador for Angostura Rum on there, the Macallan, Heaven Hill, people like legends, Thomas Estes, Julio Bermejo, Ian Burrell. It's a really cool thing to check out, especially if you're interested in the business of booze. That's what Elaine covers on Celebrating the Brand Ambassador, and I invite you to check it out. It goes live every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern on Elaine Duff's, that's E-L-A-Y-N-E, Elaine, D-U-F-F, like Duff Beer from The Simpsons. Elaine Duff's Facebook page. Go there every Wednesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, or you can go to her Celebrate the Brand Ambassador YouTube channel. Speaking of all that stuff, follow me at The Imbiber at WWD_podcast. That's where we do it on social media. There will be some video up there of Joe Beatrice and Harry Lennox. Next week's guest, very excited to let you know. Next week on this very program, the one and only Maynard James Keenan, lead singer of Tool, A Perfect Circle, Pussifer, the founder and winemaker for Merkin Vineyards and Caduceus Cellars. Maynard James Keenan will be with us next episode. And the following episode after that, Nick Jonas and John Varvatos will be joining us. And then the episode after that, comedian Big J Okerson. Man, we got a month. We got a month here in April. Exciting. One other thing, on a bit of a down note, I want to acknowledge my friend Jason Smith. Jason was the CEO, it's difficult to say it that way, he was the CEO of Starburns Audio and the network that this show is on. And a few years ago, I got to meet Jason. I'm friends with his wife, and she connected us. I had a show called Drinky Fun Time, and that was the first show I did for Starburns Audio, and Jason was a big champion of that show, and as well as this show, What We're Drinking. He has always been very supportive, and a week, not this past Friday, the Friday before, Jason died suddenly. He had a heart attack at 43 years old. And I am still processing that. It's very sad. He leaves behind a wife, Stephanie, and daughter, Sarah, and a lot of friends and family members. And I am very sad, and I miss him, and I will always miss him. And so when you're, if you have a glass now, or if you, next time you have a drink in your glass, maybe raise a toast in memory of Jason Smith, the former CEO of Starburns Audio. Joining me now on the program is a man of innumerable talents, and among them is acting. He appeared in a host of films and TV shows, including The Five Heartbeats, The Matrix series, Ray, Zack Snyder's Justice League, and lest we forget, once upon a time, he did appear on an episode of Perry Mason, The Case of the Defiant Daughter. We'll spend most of the time talking about that. He currently stars on the NBC series, The Blacklist. Our old friend, Harry Lennox. How are you, man?
Dan, I'm great, man. It's great to see you. You just were listing off all that stuff. I forgot about most of it, but I'm glad you didn't forget about the Perry Mason Case of the Defiant Daughter. That was a lot of fun working with Raymond Burr.
Do you remember what you played on the Case of the Defiant Daughter?
I remember my name was Keith. I was an assistant DA, and of course I had to go up against Perry Mason. Of course, I got my ass kicked.
I was going to say, did you win? Any chance you won that case? Wait a minute, man. Harry, that was 30 years ago. You do, and that's the name. Do you remember Keith's last name?
No.
Keith Warner, it says.
Wow.
Keith Warner, according to IMDb. Wow, that's pretty impressive that you remember that, man. I mean, it is funny. Well, first of all, let me have a toast with you, because it's always great to see you. And we are drinking barrel spirits. They have Seagrass, which is a brand new release. Whenever I get the new stuff, right? Like, so Barrel Craft Spirits is one of the best producers of whiskey in the United States. And whenever I got the good stuff coming along and I try to think on who I want to have on the show drinking it with me, Harry, your name is always at the top of that list because you genuinely appreciate whiskey. You don't just drink, you genuinely appreciate it. And so the fact that this thing, this barrel Seagrass, is hot off the presses, it's a blend of American and Canadian rye whiskeys, and it's aged in three different types of casks, Harry: Martinique rum agricole cask, apricot brandy cask, and Madeira barrels. So this is going to be a treat, and I have not tried it either. In fact, I probably should. How are you drinking it right now?
I've got some rocks on it.
All right, yeah, I'm gonna do it a little bit neat first. I got a little Glencairn glass here. I'm gonna pour it in and take a little nose on there. And man, and cheers to you, buddy.
Cheers, brother. Good to see you.
Good to see you. First impression?
Oh, that's terrific. You know, it's sweet, but I can taste some of those notes that you were talking about, you know, maybe some of the rum.
Yeah, I'm getting, I mean, it's got a lot of the classic rye flavors going on.
Yeah,
that cinnamon and it was spice on there too. And I get a little bit of pear notes and maybe some grapefruit, but man, it's got I maybe put a little splash of spring water in there, I think, which will open it up a little.
Open it up. Yeah.
And
well, this ice is going to do that for me.
This is not for the faint of heart here. This is 59.2% ABV. So this is a 118.4 proof rye whiskey. So settle in for this one, man. I mean, this thing's got some kick to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. But it's still sweet. It's very smooth still. Because I think of all those fruit notes that you were talking about, in addition to the rye. So it's Canadian and American. Huh?
Yeah, it's a blend of Canadian and rye whiskeys. And so what they do, they're an independent blender and bottler. They source whiskeys and rums, and they came on the scene. When would the barrel come around? I guess it was probably around, it seems about 7-8 years ago in Louisville, Kentucky. The guy, Joe Beatrice, who's going to be joining us a little bit later on the show, will give me some more of that detailed information. But it's one of those brands that just came out and right from the get-go started putting out phenomenal stuff and winning a lot of awards and whatnot. And that's how they came on my radar when I was writing for Rob Report, because, you know, Rob Report tries to focus on the most exclusive, best stuff out there. And this qualifies for sure.
Right. Well, it deserves to be on that list, and it's very good. I'm never really, you know, I generally more of a bourbon man and a Scotch man than I am rye, but I do like good rye, and this is good. It's light, you know, and yet it has the kick that you're talking about. It's very satisfying. Very, very satisfying.
Well, I made an old fashioned. My favorite drinks, and I want to ask you right after this, you know, a rye old fashioned is in the top three for sure. It's just, to me, it's a perfect cocktail. I mean, it just, got a little sugar in there, a tiny bit of soda water. I got the seagrass is obviously the spirit. I put two little cherries in there, two little brandy cherries in there, and I garnished it with I expressed the orange peel on there, and I'm going to try it right here. Here we go. And you know what?
You make a nice cocktail, Dan. That's a nice, you know your stuff when it comes to cocktailing.
Well, it never lets me down, that one. And that's what I want to ask you, Harry. Let's do the proverbial desert island situation. Or what are your five favorite alcoholic beverages? It doesn't necessarily, it can be a cocktail, but it could be beer. It could be a specific wine. You got five things that you only get to drink, these five things for the rest of your life. What are they?
Well, I love gin. I switched from gin to gin from whiskey, mostly of the Scotch or bourbon variety, probably about 8 years ago as my number one.
Gin became your number one.
Gin became my number one.
Was there a reason? Did something happen? Did you have a very late night and get into a fight with the whiskey and the rye, as can happen sometimes?
It was really just the calories. That's okay. All it was. No other reason than that. It packs a lot of calories into it. The gin is a little bit less. The vodka has, I think, the least amount, at least for a while it did.
Well, I think this rye whiskey, I can't be sure. I'll ask Joe, but it probably 80 calories if you're drinking it neat.
Yeah, that's the typical, what the normal pour is about 82 calories or so. Whereas gin, I think, is something more like high 60s, and vodka.
I'm sorry,
I think
this is funny to me. So wait a minute, you switched, gin became your favorite over about 15 calories.
Yes.
Wow. Is this the life? This is the we're getting an insight to the life of an actor right now. You're like, well, let me see. Over the course of a night, if I have six drinks, that's 90 calories I'm saving myself, right? That's the difference between getting the role and not getting the role, right?
It could be. That's a half a beer, you know.
Sure.
You know, the board
okay.
That you could have.
So gin.
So I would say gin.
You just all gin, or you're just all gin, or are you going to make a specific gin cocktail? Is there one that jumps out?
I'm primarily a Bombay Sapphire guy. You know what I mean? That just happens to be the one. I don't, you know, Tanqueray is cool. That was what Betty Davis drank, by the way, Tanqueray.
Okay.
But yeah, when it comes to whiskeys, I guess my favorite thing is probably Macallan's 12.
The Scotch.
That's my go-to Scotch.
Okay.
And then I'm more or less, you know, for the bourbon until now, I am, you know, I would go for Maker's Mark or something in that.
Okay.
In that family. But this is very, very good. Bullet, you know, I've had in terms of rye before. But in terms of the five, it would be gin, Scotch.
What about a cocktail?
It'd probably be... A Cosmo.
Really?
From with Tito's.
Okay. You didn't strike me as a Cosmo guy.
Well, you know,
you like martinis. I've been with you when you drink martini. I came to see you in New York, and you took me to a bar specifically because you said they made a great martini.
The way that I happen to martini, Dan, I don't consider it a cocktail because I don't put any damn vermouth in it.
Just straight gin. Isn't that the best? Whoever, that idea was the best idea ever. You know, I'm going to do a martini. Here's a way we can get here's a workaround. Here's a workaround to people saying maybe you're drinking too much is instead of calling it a 3.5 ounce shot of gin, straight shot of gin, just call it put it in this glass, maybe chuck an olive in it, and it's a martini. Yeah.
It's a martini.
Nothing else in there. Yeah.
That's right. You know, somebody talked to me about, I was at dinner the other night, a great restaurant called Maria on Central Park South. They do a great job. And a woman heard me ask for a martini. I ordered a martini. She thought I said a whisper martini. And she said, because she presumed that I just wanted a whisper of vermouth.
Okay.
But I didn't say whisper. I just said a straight gin martini, but I like that. So I have whisper martinis. That's a long way of saying it.
A whisper martini. Yeah.
A whisper of vermouth. But it's a rumor. It's whispered.
Yeah, and I thought maybe, I thought she would be confused and think you meant a Vesper, which is vodka and gin. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I think I did know that. You know, I've never had one of those. Are they good?
Wait. Your favorite thing is gin, but you said vodka's close behind.
Yeah.
You would think that the Vesper Martini would be on your radar, and well, it is now. I mean, yeah, basically, you know, the version that I kind of like, I would probably do, say, 3 ounces, again, just get around. I do it with gin, heavier on the gin, maybe 3 ounces of gin, maybe an ounce of vodka, and then Lillet Blanc, you know, the aperitif. Put that, yeah. a little lemon twist in there. That's a Vesper Martini. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to try that. I'll probably try that on Friday.
I could be wrong, and if I am, folks, hit me up at the Imbiber and tell me I'm wrong, but I believe it was invented by the man, what's his name, who wrote the James Bond novels.
Ian Fleming.
I believe Ian Fleming invented the Vesper Martini recipe in a Bond novel. I could be wrong. I'm not going to look it up because I'm going to throw myself out there. If I am wrong and you're listening right now, I want you to hit me up at the Imbiber and fact check me on this. I like being fact checked. So, but you used to drink beer too, Har, right?
Yes. And that would round out, you know, if I haven't filled up my allotment, that would be number five. I grew up, you know, really on beer. It saved my life. That's a true story. My mother had me 2 months prematurely, and I was in an incubator for at least many weeks. She wouldn't even see me. But wow. Her mother told her, she said, get him out of that incubator, take him home and give him beer. Because I couldn't hold anything on my stomach. And it saved my life. So
that's crazy.
Yeah.
You were
now, that's 200 calories per bottle.
But it, you know, got to go those extra calories because it is a lifesaver. You were born in Chicago, right? I believe. And
yes.
I'm going to go here. Your mom's from Chicago. Wasn't your dad from like the South? Your dad's from like New Orleans or something.
Well, they're both from the South. My dad's from Louisiana, was a, you know, Creole down in St. John the Baptist Parish. And my mom was born in North Carolina, but raised in Virginia. They met in Chicago.
They met in Chicago. So you grew up there. Yeah. You went to Northwestern, correct?
Yeah.
Acting. We talked about some of your earlier roles. I actually find this kind of fun when I was looking back, because I'm like, you've been in so many things, man. You know, like I went back, and you know, the Five Heartbeats was kind of the big break, right? With that 1991, mm-hmm. Would you say that was your big break?
Yeah, I would say that from a Hollywood standpoint, you know, actors have different mediums, you know, from a theatrical standpoint, live theater. It was August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which recently became a movie.
On HBO Chadwick Boseman and...
I think HBO's at Netflix. It might be Netflix. I'm not sure. But Chadwick Boseman is nominated.
Viola Davis, right?
Viola Davis nominated. But this was, you know, a play that put me on the map as an actor in Chicago back in 1988.
Okay.
And then I did the Five Heartbeats in 90, and it came out in 91. And by the way, it's just celebrating its 30th anniversary. It came out 30 years ago.
When's the party, man? So is there a chance we get a Five Heartbeats party going on in LA this summer?
I think, you know, it might be just the two of us, but yeah, absolutely.
You're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. We're all seeing that. I don't know how are things in New York now? Is it, you mentioned that you went to dinner. Is it starting to get better?
So the restaurants in the city are at 50%. You can go in at 50% capacity. They're about to ease the travel restrictions for quarantining, on either side of the flight. I have received one of my vaccination shots. I'm going to go get the other one tomorrow, Pfizer one. So I believe that it's more or less coming back. And you know, they're projecting out things for Broadway, for example, in December. So it looks like there are signs of life. And I think the numbers are pretty low, you know, relative to other places. So, yeah, they're doing well. And you know, knock on wood, looks like we're coming out of the fog.
Yeah, it's been a big sense of relief. It's funny you mentioned the Broadway. I've got another friend and his wife are big on Broadway, Colin Donnell and Patty Murin. And we just talked about it. And he said, you know, he got a little emotional talking about the idea that having people back in theaters again, you know, and just that it's weird to think how used to this we've gotten, to not doing that, to not being in theaters, to not being in movie theaters and in plays and concerts, and that there is a strong possibility, if things keep moving in the right direction, that say by the fall.
That's what they're saying. Right now, I heard that it was specifically a show, I think, about Princess Diana. I think it might be called Diana or something like that. So they said that they're going to open in December. So that's the projection. I guess they must be getting some sort of permission to say that, some kind of a green light. But yeah, man, you know, it's a very interesting thing. I don't know if it's going to bounce back immediately. If you think about it, Dan, there's 1,000 seats probably in the average Broadway theater. That's just Broadway. I think it'll be much easier to handle in regional theaters in terms of social distancing, should that still be the case. But as these vaccinations is something on the order of 500 million shots, I think, that have been given in the United States alone. So I think by the fall, people will feel.
What about more outdoor stuff, Harry? Because like in the park and Central Park, so the warm weather's coming.
Right.
And so there's no excuse why we can't at least, you know, create situations where we can consume entertainment outdoors. You know, Shakespeare in the Park, or you were doing Michael Bay earlier, Michael Bay in the Park. I got to indulge. I had a magical, I mentioned Harry's house, and one of the most magical nights I remember being there a couple years ago, and it was Harry and Angus McFadden from Braveheart. Robert the Bruce and a bunch of million other shows, and Harry and Angus are old friends and they've worked together, and we'd been drinking, that's for sure. And it was getting late. It was getting well into the evening, and you and Angus were out on your porch, and the view behind you is all of at Los Angeles. You can see all of Los Angeles, one of the best views of any of my friends' homes. And you guys were a little bit drunk and you were doing some Shakespeare, and it was just, and not in any pretentious way. I mean, if I say that, you might, oh no, but it was just two guys who had the training, had the goods, had the skills, and had a shitload of whiskey in them, and started doing Shakespeare, and it was flawless. You probably fucked up a million things, but to me, it was flawless. I'm watching going, this is so great, man.
Hey, Dad, it's a magical trick. The more you drink, the better we see.
The better you are. Have you ever thought about that? Like, here's a great way to make your stuff work. Like, if you don't think it's that great, is just hand out booze when people are coming into the theater. Here, we're gonna have a 3-shot minimum before you walk in. We just can't make it this seagrass, man, because this stuff will knock you, again, 118.4 proof. It will knock you on your ass. We will jump back and forth between the way. Do you have a glass we can try this thing neat without any water on it?
I don't have one, but I'm gonna finish this.
All right, you finish that, because I would like you to try it neat as well, because I'm what I'm interested in is knowing if you feel like that amount of alcohol in it, that ABV, is too much for you to handle, you know, or on that level? Yeah. Is it something you could see yourself sipping that way, or do you feel like you just have to put a little bit of water in it?
Well, to be honest, I'm gonna try it neat. Mm-hmm. This is a disclaimer. I did try some neat a couple of days ago.
The whole bottle's almost gone, folks. Just so you know, Harry's kidding.
That's true, but I didn't do it by myself. I have a little woman that runs around here pilfering things.
She takes.
I call her my wife.
Your wife likes the seagrass, huh?
She does like it. You know, she has. I think this, you know, she's developed a taste for whiskey, for spirits. Frankly, she used to only drink a bit of wine from time to time, but now she'll like a cocktail, and so she had a not a whole lot of this, but I've had it neat, but I'm going to try it again. But this, I feel perfectly fine now drinking what I just had.
Okay.
And the booziness thing, it doesn't seem.
It's not too much.
Hold on.
There's the.
Somebody's. Yeah.
That's.
Yeah. But it feels very.
Did you get the part? Was that what that was? I always feel like when actors get calls, it's always, but did you get the part?
Yeah. I bowled it.
Have you had that moment though? I mean, I know you've been at this a long time, man. You've had a tremendous amount of success. You're just a brilliant actor, but do you remember those moments where, and do you ever reflect on them? It's a difficult thing to do, right? It's this profession, the thing that you do is a difficult thing in that there's a tremendous amount of rejection.
Right.
I don't know of many other fields where you're told no, no, no. And for reasons you're probably never going to understand, you know, I have actor friends that say they walk in the room and they don't even get to say a line. They look at him and go, nope, sorry.
Right.
So when you do have something comes along that you really want, do you remember those moments earlier in your career where you got a part? And how excited did you get? Did you ever have one of those moments where you just put the phone down and went, fuck, I did it.
I'm trying, you know, it's a very good question. By the way, I did finish that one. This is neat.
Okay.
This is neat.
Still in the area. I'm going to need here.
He's
pondering this over some seagrass. It's substantial, you know, isn't it?
It's a substantial hit, to use your language. It's great by itself, but it's almost... If I were just going to have it neat, I would have it after dinner. Do you mean? I might have it with a bit of fruit or some chocolate.
What about a cigar? What about a cigar with that?
Or a cigar.
Yeah.
But I would probably have some water on the side as I do. And but it's a delicious rye, and you know, I've just my palate now has gotten used to things a little bit more diluted, so that I can sense it, you know, as the ice is sort of going into it, I can, you know, take a kind of more generous swig of it. But it is there's no questioning in its quality. It's just that for me, I would probably tend to drink too much of it straight, and because of its ABV,
that could be a problem. No, I definitely would recommend this thing in a cup. I mean, this thing in an old fashioned is fantastic. I would, if you're going to drink, I would put it either, definitely at least put it on the rocks, because you said you get that dilution. That's a good thing because it starts to open it up. You're able to identify the nuances in the whiskey, things that when the alcohol is that high, you can miss because the alcohol is overpowering. Okay. Put a little water in there and it smooths it out. And it goes, oh, here's this. Here's when I mentioned the grapefruit and you know, the various other notes that I was getting on there. I mean, even like there's a little bit of like a sandiness to it, this texture-wise, like a sandy texture to it. But the flavor, again, I got grapefruit, I got pear, I got a little bit of rosemary. And that stuff you might not get if you're drinking it just neat. But... Right. Anyway, getting back to your moment, like the moment when you just you go, man, I worked so hard and I got it.
I don't think that I ever had that sort of moment of triumphal jubilation, so to speak. I think on a certain level, Dan, just to be honest with you, sometimes I feel like I'm entitled to all of the parts. You know, I'm trained. I did the work. At least for a little while there, I stayed ready and in shape and all of these things. So I feel like on a certain level, while grateful for the work, you know, I was never like, well, this is going to make me, you know, happy and fulfilled. Because once you get the job, I think the hardest part for me is getting the job. Once you get the job, you have to do the work. And you put into, after a little while, it gets a little more certain. That is, you have a process by which you work. You may not know all of the answers yet, but you know that you'll figure it out, that if there's an intelligent writer and a good story, that you are just one aspect of that story. You may be the lead or some person on the side of that, but you still have to put it into work, Dad. You know, you got to learn the lines. You got to get the chemistry right with the other actors. And a lot of times, you know, you're talking about your friends who on site, prima facie, as they would say in the law, they got rejected. Well, because they knew that the chemistry wasn't right. I mean, but this is a very personal business. You don't look the part. You are not the part. You're not what they're looking for. They know that right away sometimes. And why belabor it? It hurts more the further along the road that you get, because then you start investing.
Oh, I know that. I know that feeling. Yeah. You know, the last thing you want to do is get far enough along where you actually think it could work, because it's not going to.
Yeah. You know, I think it's only that it seems that way, Dan. For example, I've only rarely made the mistake of thinking, oh, this can mean X amount per episode.
Yeah.
But and frequently I haven't gotten those jobs. But then when I didn't think that, I didn't get the job either.
Sure. But look, here, you know, you've got something that I think most actors would love to have. You have been on a hit series. What year is The Blacklist in?
Eight.
Now that is Eight. Not only are you getting to work and do what you love and do it regularly and get paid, but that's the kind of security that I think everybody that's gotten into this business wants, because it affords you the opportunity, and you do a lot of this, to do other passion projects, things that you produce, and you're doing a lot of that, and you've got the theater. Let's talk a little bit of the theater project you've got going as well. I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, some years ago, thank you for asking about it. Some years ago, at this point, a company there is the Congo Square Theater Company. They are 21 years old at this point, but they don't have a home. They're an itinerant company out of Chicago. As I say, sterling track record. They won, I think, the Small Theater Tony Award a few years back or something like this. A lot of celebrated accolades, all of these things. Don't have a home. And so the artistic director, executive director at the time, asked me, hey, can you help us find a home? And it hit me that, you know, well, where can we put this place? And the best place would be where it's needed most. And the place where that is in Chicago is on the South Side. And so I thought, if it's good for the Congo Square Theater Company, it's probably good for a lot of companies that are beyond theater companies, dance companies, music companies, ballet companies, spoken word people, musicians of all kinds, cultural, expressive, living art needs a home that is a state-of-the-art home on the South Side of Chicago, like there is on the North Side. To some extent, even on the West Side, there's limited, you know, places, but nonetheless, they have state-of-the-art theaters that can accommodate the hunger for culture in their own backyard. Deserves it. Much of the blues and rock and roll and soul music and a lot of the theater companies and dance derives from that very part of the world. Muddy Waters lived in the neighborhood where this theater is, for example. Louis Armstrong lived very close by. Ida B. Wells, Louis Sullivan, the great architect, lived in that neighborhood. And yet there's nothing when it comes to a viable theater. And so it became my plan, goal, to create what I like to call the Black Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, so that we can provide a home for already existing companies. That's what the Lincoln Center does. The New York Philharmonic and the Metropolitan Opera, American Ballet, they were all in existence when Rockefeller put some money down in the middle of New York and bought them all to a central hub where people can see them. They do some 3,000 events per year at the Lincoln Center on their campus. It's many theaters and classrooms and places like that, but stages, film, screens, and so forth. And so this is what this will be. It will be a multidisciplinary performance arts center, and we intend to have a campus and the whole thing. And that's all going to be done under the auspices of the African American Museum for the Performing Arts. We call it AMPA. And then the home of AMPA, where it presents much of this work, will be at the Lillian Marcy Center for the Performing Arts, which is named after my mother and my mentor. My mother is Lillian, and my mentor was Marcella, or Marcy Gilley. So they really were my inspiration in terms of what can be done with not a whole lot of money, but a lot of love and a lot of initiative, what you can build. And so this is intended to be an incubator and a sanctuary to house these arts, which are very delicate, but also which are really what have gotten us through this 400-year sojourn in the United States of America, where Black people have really provided the only original indigenous forms of expressive arts have come from this population, and they
wait a minute. Didn't the Rolling Stones invent blues? Don't let me fact check me on this one, but I'm pretty sure. By the way, there is a great video. If you go on YouTube, you can find it. It's Muddy Waters is playing a bar, I think in Chicago in the 70s, and the Stones are the biggest band in the world, and they show up. You got to Google this, and they YouTube it. And they show up in the bar, and Muddy's playing, and obviously it was kind of set up, but you know, it's 1975, something like that. It's Jagger, Richards, Ronnie Wood. Yep. I remember Jagger's wearing a salmon-colored tracksuit, as you would if you're Mick Jagger. Wow. And they get up on stage, and it's Muddy Waters' band, and they play Mannish Boy, and it is... It's incredible to watch it, to see here's the guy, the originator, here's the guy who did it, and then this is the band that took it. I'm not going to say so. Every artist is a cannibal, every poet's a thief, right, Harry? Here we go. So they took it and made it famous, right? And
Yes, they did.
And watching them all on stage together and just the all vibing with that music. So the thing you're doing, where is it in the process? How far along is it now?
Well, we are close. We want to start developing it. That is to say, well, we have developed. We want to start building out on it in September of this year. So the fourth quarter of this year, and then to finish it sometime in the fourth quarter of 2022. So we're just about there. We have a $3 to $5 million, what they call a deficiency. That is, we have to answer how we're going to come up with that before the city, who has been very supportive and has given us, you know, a promise of some support financially, before they sign off on it and let us actually start building. But let me just say this real quick thing about the Stones. You know, I see these things with Mick Jagger showed up everywhere. There's this movie that my friends did called Amazing Grace. A guy by the name of Alan Elliott. Put together this movie about Aretha Franklin singing in an LA church in South Central Los Angeles. It is her and James Cleveland and some church people eating fried chicken probably right after the rehearsal. and I have to tell you, Mick Jagger's there. Cindy Pollack is there because they love the music. And so he would show up, man. He didn't care what kind of hole in the wall it was. If he knew something authentic was happening, him and Keith Richards and them boys could play with anybody.
They could
sing with anybody.
And the beauty of the Stones too was they, you know, now it's called cultural appropriation, but back in the day it was just them. I truly believe it was they were, you know, I read Keith Richard's autobiography, and he said, yeah, you know, meeting Muddy Waters to them was, you know, like seeing God, you know, yeah, like, because they're, you know, these are British kids that came up. But what I loved about the Stones is they would just, you know, when they had the country, when they would do the country stuff, and they just lean into, like, you know, Dead Flowers, when, yeah, you're sitting there. And, you know, I just imagine, like, was there a wink for Jagger? Was he winking at it at all? Or was he just, he didn't give a shit. He's like, I want to sing. I want to sing with that twang. I want to sing like Muddy Waters. I want to do this, right?
You know, there's a whole bunch, Dan, you know, and this has always fascinated me, this kind of cultural history and so forth. You know, if you think about those Southern accents with the twang, all that stuff, we can directly trace it from the United Kingdom, from Britain. In many cases, a lot of those, you know, the Southern accents were really the kind of first original American accents, but they came immediately, more or less, from England. If you think about Virginia and Jamestown, Virginia, and all those places that were colonized and so forth, that developed into the Southern accent. And so I think to some extent it's going full circle. It really is a kind of return. So he recognized something. Those songs, even songs like our Star Spangled Banner, that tune is a British military song. Our Country 'Tis of Thee is God Save the Queen. Not, I think something like that, but the fields of amber, waves of cran, for purple mountain majesty, up on the pretty, right? America the Beautiful is God Save the Queen. That's the tune. And so a lot of this stuff is really a return, the kind of form of the 1-4-5 progression. All of these things are based, like, really in classical musical forms that were adopted by Americans and were really taken to their kind of a beautiful arrival by Black people who put rhythms on it and who put accents and stress on certain metrical feet, all kinds of stuff. But all that stuff is based on forms that are European harmonies, melodies to some extent, to a little bit more limited extent, in African rhythms. But it became this bouillabaisse, this gumbo of culture that, again, has really been the only original things.
Harry, are you sure that white people didn't invent jazz? Are you sure?
Some white people claim to have done it. There is a white group, I can't remember their name, that said that we invented jazz. I'm just telling you, it's not true, but that's what they said.
We had to have done something. Podcasting?
Well, you guys make a pretty big...
Maybe white people invented podcasting. I mean, come on. Give us something.
Probably.
We know who invented what's a form of entertainment where you can just talk about yourself and how great you are? Podcasting. Yes. Let's do that.
Yeah. Electronic narcissism.
Yes, that's it. I want to very quickly, a couple, when I'm looking back, we started looking back at your IMDb. You're in Bob Roberts, man.
Yeah.
I completely forgot that. I just love that movie.
Wow, okay.
I love Bob Roberts. Did you not like Bob Roberts?
No.
You did not
like it? I didn't know.
What's that?
It's a great movie. I didn't know that you liked it, you know.
Oh, my God. Well, I even remember his, what was the song he sang? The Times. He was a folk singer. Tim Robbins plays like a singer who's this arch conservative. And the one album was The Times They Are a Changin' Back.
That's right.
And the best is that was a joke until Trump ran on it, you know, like, let's go, you know, and won on it, you know, he just went, yeah. But, and there were so many people in that movie, and I want to go back and watch, but I'm just trying to do it all the time. I mean, Jack Black was in that movie. I believe that was one of his, yeah, he played this fanatical, and again, it all seemed like a joke back then, but it all has come to fruition.
Big movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very prescient. And
it did seem like a joke, but Dan, I would remind you that now, when that movie was made, is about 20 years ago.
When it was made? No. 19. 30. I think Bob Roberts is 1992. 30. Yeah, 30 years ago.
So that's 30 years ago. And it wasn't far-fetched in any way at the time. There was, you know, all kinds of people that Trump was a direct descendant of.
Yeah.
There were people like Dick Gephardt and Newt Gingrich. And
that's right.
Saying the exact same stuff that Trump is saying now. you know, and people like that. So this has always been the polarity in the United States. It's always been conservatism. It's actually moved rather remarkably to the center, as has liberalism has actually moved, you know, the kind of, for example, I was a big Clinton guy. Still, I campaigned for his wife twice for president. But the Clinton Democrats, like I consider myself, that is the centrist Democrat, moderate Democrat, are considered conservative now.
Oh, yeah.
So that's how far. Do you know what I mean? Like,
things
people
have
look
gone.
At me like, yeah, like I'm the enemy.
I'm going to get off politics right now. Very quickly, because I'm going to let you go in a couple minutes here. But I'm just looking, man, like movies that I did, like Clockers. I love the book, actually. Richard Price wrote the book, right? Mm-hmm. I loved it. Mo Money, Get on the Bus, The Matrix movies, The Human Stain. How is working with, we'll leave it at that. How is working with the man on that one? Jesus Christ.
Anthony Hopkins.
I'm sitting here going like I'm going. I was about to say Silence of the Lambs. Yeah, I've had some Beryl Seagrass. I'm just going to admit it right now. But how is working with Anthony Hopkins?
Beryl is great, by the way. Great. That was my second time working with him. I had done a movie with him called Titus, and based on Titus Andronicus. So Human Stain was my second go around with him. We had a very nice conversation leading up to that. But, you know, we were very fast friends on Titus. Got a chance to spend a great deal of time with him, sit at the foot of the master, so to speak, and listen to him, you know, break down his process and watch him do it. So it's wonderful whenever you have a maestro, a top professor like that. You know, it is a rare occasion. He can't do every project, so you know we have to really appreciate what it is that he lends his time and his attention to.
You consider him one of the greats that we've had?
There's no question. Like, it's not just that I consider him. He's one of the greats.
Yeah.
The greatest actors on the planet of all time. He's got something, you know, he's Welsh and comes from more or less the same village as in Wales as did the great Richard Burton. But these men are titans, you know, for actors who dig the use of language and pedigree, training, attention to craft, all of these things. He is, I don't know of one who I would prefer to have ever worked with. Like, you know, I love him. And as an actor and as a very generous man, spent some time with me. We had lunch. Actually, when he called me Dan, I thought that it was Angus McFadden, who you mentioned earlier, playing a joke on me, because he used to call me an impersonator, and he did a very good Anthony Hopkins impersonation. And one day I was like, hey, what the hell do you want, Angus? And it was actually Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, no kidding. That's great.
He said, you and Angus have been doing those impersonations of me again, I see. But listen, I want to have lunch. Perhaps you can find some time to join me for lunch.
We had a great. That's a good Anthony Hopkins. You know, I sometimes imagine if I could do this show, and obviously podcasting wasn't around then, but how great it would have been to be able to have, and I love having people like yourself on, but to be able to have, you know, Richard Harris and right. Peter O'Toole, and because you know what, if you're doing a show called What We're Drinking and you're having Peter O'Toole on, first of all, everything, the answer to that question is everything. And the Richard Harrises of the world, and I imagine Hopkins back in the day, and you know, all these guys. Yeah, that would have been something, I think. But I'm glad I get you, man. It's nice to have you on. It's always great.
Get Angus. You should get Angus sometime.
I don't know where the hell he is. He goes around. We never can really pin him down. But
he's mostly in Panama. But we'll get him for you.
We'll find him. We'll track him down. Harry Lennox, The Blacklist. When is the show's wrapping up soon? This season coming up the end when May usually kind of ends.
I think so. Yeah, it ends generally in May. We'll be shooting until June, Early June, we got a late start this year. Normally we knock off at the end of April, but we'll be there until June this year. I do another show called Billions. So
my That's right. Is that back now? Because it got cut off like 7 episodes in, I think it got cut off. And then
everything else.
And you were playing a more prominent role this season, right?
Right.
He's trying to develop something in a neighborhood and he needs you. When I say he, I mean Damian Lewis's character needs you to make this thing happen, right?
That's correct. Very good, Dan. You're clearly watching. Of course.
What else am I fucking doing, man? What do you think I'm doing? What do you think I do? This is me. Look at. This is what I do. I watch TV and I experiment with hairstyles. What do you think of this hairstyle? Come on, tell me what you think. Be honest.
I like it. You look like you belong on some sort of Final Four team right now.
I feel like you're mocking my hairstyle. Are you mocking my hairstyle?
You look like one of guys like Tyler Hero or something that play. No. You know, like the new school.
I look like some old guy who is pretending to be Tyler Hero. Yeah. Hey, look at me. Do you have any demand, Harry? Is there any demand you make when you're doing a movie? I mean, you know, get a trailer, you get stuff like that. Could you say, I want a bottle of this every day in my trailer?
No. Normally, any kind of demand I would make would be, you know, sort of like for billing. It wouldn't even be a demand. It would be a request.
Gotcha.
But no, I've never got to that point where I can, you know, have only blue M&Ms, you know, in my dirt bowl or anything like that. So, and I don't need to do that. I can pull out all my own M&Ms, I guess. But, you know, I know that people do it, but I'm not cut from that kind of cloth. Maybe I could do it, but
you could.
I don't.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Harry Lennox, The Blacklist, NBC. It's always great to see you, man. And I look forward to seeing you in person soon. We will tip back some whiskey. If you can afford the extra calories, I mean, you can have gin. Why don't you just air? Why don't you just get you a bottle of air for Harry?
Yeah,
I'm sure
I would approve.
I look forward to seeing you again soon, man. I appreciate you doing this. And we'll be back right after the other side of this word from whoever. And we're going to talk to Joe Beatrice from Barrel Craft Spirits. Folks, I've never admitted this on the show before, but I'm a guy. Yeah, it's true. And as a guy, I'm here to tell you that so much of our identity is wrapped up in our hair. That's why when we get into our 20s and 30s and start noticing the first signs of hair loss, it definitely feels like panic time. Thankfully, now there's Keeps, the simple and easy way to keep your hair. Treatments start at just $10 per month. Plus, for a limited time, you can get your first month free. That's right, free. Go to keeps.com/drinking to receive your first month of treatment for free. Take care of your hair, and your hair will take care of you. Joining me now, as promised, the founder, Barrel Craft Spirits, old friend of the show, Joe Beatrice. Joe, how are you, man?
I'm awesome. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to see you, as always. Harry Lennox and I just were having a very good time drinking the seagrass, the latest expression. How many do you have in the portfolio? How many different expressions of barrel would you say you've made? Now, you've been around since, 2013, right?
Yep.
How many expressions have you put out, roughly?
Well, I've never added it all up, but there's the bourbon, the whiskey, the rum, and the rye lines, and then we have all the private releases, which constitute hundreds of different releases. But then, aside from those, we have the special releases, which are which the group is Dovetail, Armida, and Seagrass. So, these are three whiskeys that are always available at this point that we blend over and over again. And there are minor variances, but those are the three that are core.
We both loved it. The Seagrass. I had it in Old Fashioned. It's so tasty. When you've got something that's got, you know, we're talking 118 plus proof here. Do you recommend try it neat, or do you want to put a little water in before you even take that first sip?
Well, the way I recommend trying it is trying it neat first. You want to nose it. You want to taste it. And then after that, then you can proof it down with water, preferably over ice. And this makes a spectacular cocktail. But yeah, everything we do is cask strength. So it's sort of the luck of the draw, whatever those barrels end up being when we dump them and blend them, is what the proof is.
What informs that choice? Why is that? Everything you do is cask strength.
That was a core tenet of the company from the beginning. The only water we have in our place is drinking water. we don't dilute anything. It comes from the fact that the first time I ever tasted whiskey out of a barrel, I just couldn't believe how amazing it was. Because remember, we lived in an 80 proof world, you know, and all of a sudden it just opened up as this spectacular complex array of just concentration. And I just was amazed and thought, why doesn't everybody drink whiskey like this? And so from the beginning, everything we did was cask strength.
One of the things that I mentioned to Harry was just how quickly Barrel came on the scene and then just started winning awards and was almost from the get-go just embraced and recognized as a premium brand. How'd that happen?
I think
because it doesn't happen all the time. It certainly is. It's no easy feat to come out of nowhere and just.
Yes. We've been fortunate. A couple of things are going on. The time we came out was the time was right. We have always been transparent. And I think that you have to put it into context. There are dozens of companies that talk about the source whiskey, but when we did it, we were one of the few, if the only one, that really came right at that straight ahead and said, we're blenders. We blend. We blend in the Scottish tradition of finding great whiskeys and putting them together. So that transparency, I think, really helped. And the other one was the single-minded focus on blending. That's what we do. We spend our days blending, tasting. When we get into Seagrass in a couple minutes, maybe when I talk about like how we ended up, what goes into this blend, it's incredibly complex. And so that I think that had a lot to do with it because our focus was always on the flavor. And the other part of it is we don't talk about our products. We let other people talk about our products. We let bloggers, influencers, competitions, anybody talk about our whiskey.
Well, and just the word of the mouth on bourbon lovers. I mean, when we did, you know, we've talked about this before, Joe, and when I had you guys at Pebble Beach, when I did the Whiskey River event up there, and we, on the opening night, we had this tasting room, and I think there were about eight different whiskeys in the room, and yours was one of them. Will was up there pouring, and to just watch the reaction to the people had, and you know, and then throughout the weekend I'd have people coming up to me and they'd say, you know, not just yours, but certainly yours was one of the ones where they said, I didn't know about this. And now I just love it. And that's kind of how it happens, right? Especially in the world of the bourbon consumers. People talk amongst themselves.
Yeah, and it's what we thought from the very beginning was also that we needed to put the glass in people's hand and let them taste it. We had to get what people taste it. So a big part of where we focus our energy was in whiskey festivals and events and tastings. We did hundreds and hundreds of them. And that really helped with spreading the word about our product.
So someone who has no idea, never been to a distillery, they've never seen the process at all, explain in the simplest terms how blending works.
Well, Seagrass is an incredibly complex blend. And the way we do it is we start with a concept of what we would think we want to achieve. And then because we have a fairly extensive library of barrels that we have, that we will either take some of them in or sample, but a lot of times we'll take a representative sample of the barrels into our place, then pull samples out of those barrels, and then begin the process of putting this blend together.
And so you, Joe, do you mind if I jump in here? But so you already have the inventory. It's not like you sat down and said, this is the flavor profile I'm going for. So now I have to go up to, let's pack our bags and head for Canada and go find the barrels that we need in Canada. You've already got this inventory in-house, stuff that you've already purchased.
Yes. And then if we do find there's a gap, we do that. We do track things down and find it. But for the most part, we're in good shape with the range of barrels and types and mash bills that we have. So we knew that Seagrass was going to be rye, a rye whiskey. And so we focused on playing around with different finishes. And this product has different ryes finished in different finishes and then blended. So the process, the process is that the Canadian rye component of it was finished in apricot brandy casks. The Indiana rye was finished in the Madeira casks. And then we took a multi-state selection of ryes from Tennessee, Indiana, Kentucky, as well as some Canadians. We blended that first and then finished it in the agricole casks, the rum agricole.
How much of that is instinct and guesswork? I know you have, obviously you've got a lot of skill that you've developed, talent, but is there an element of just let's put it in there and see what happens?
I was trying to do this slimmed down version. So to get to that point, we have already played around with dozens of combinations of the different ryes in different finishes. And this started with a selection of way more than three finishes and netted it down to these three finishes as the ones that really work together best. So we do bring in all these, we drink barrels first, we take a selection of it. We then vat some of the whiskey once we figure out what the percent blend of combination of the ryes are. So in other words, we may pull from more than one mash bill of the rye in different ages. In this case, this product is aged, there's a very little 4-year-old. It's mainly the centered around 5 to 10 plus some 14, 15-year-old Canadian in here. So the age range is very far. So we spend a lot of time first developing the blend of each of those individual rye components. And then after we've done that, then we test them all with the different finishes. And the where we ended on it, that list that I mentioned, is the way that it worked best with the flavors complementing each other. But then once we have those three components, so we blended many, many barrels to get to these three components. After we do that, we blend those three components together to get to the final blend. And then after that's done, we will use a little bit, relatively speaking, of unfinished rye to balance the flavor.
When you're working out the blend and you're trying your sampling, do you have a pretty good idea already before you go? Like, there needs to be this much grapefruit flavor in there. I want to smell this much honeydew when I'm there. Or is it kind of let the spirit speak to you and tell you what it wants to do?
It's a little of both, but it's more of the latter. So we know what the characteristics are of the different ryes, and we know when we put them together, certain things will be more predominant. And then as we're blending the initial stages of it, we can tease out more of those by balancing and using the mash bill that contributes more of that to it. We use this expression, we let flavor drive the bus, and we do, because sometimes we don't always end up in the place we started, but where we end up is where we believe is better than what we had expected.
when I spoke to Harry earlier, we talked a little bit about roles and acting and whether he got super excited when he got parts. And Harry's just the consummate professional. And he says, he always just thinks about the work. But I'm curious, in your line of work and what you do, have you had moments with the very, we talked about how many different expressions you've done. Can you remember one where you just went, holy shit, this is the best thing I could do?
You're not going to love the answer, but we get there every time we do a batch release or a blend, because we've worked so hard on it. When it's there, it's there. However, I will say, one of my personal favorites is Armida. It just speaks to me. It has the pear Amaro and rum finish. It's a bourbon, not a bourbon. We don't call it a bourbon. It's a bourbon finished in, so it's technically a whiskey. So we're not. It's not bourbon.
Don't want to break those rules, Joe. You can't. A lot of rules, man. You can't be finishing. Yeah.
We know. We're careful, and we straddle that. We're trying to communicate as much as we can. And sometimes the limitations are more technical. So it is a bourbon finished in, or our batches are a blend of straights. So these are technical terms that we have to incorporate. But the moment that our Armida came together for me was just, it was amazing. It was just, it just spoke to me. And it was, the pear component, the pear brandy, the pear eau de vie, is a West Coast distillery that makes phenomenal pear brandy. And this is just, we tried three different strains of pears and came up with this one. This was the one. The Bartlett pear one was one that was the most perfect. So that was one that I thought was that moment. Seagrass really, as we were developing it, and again, there were literally maybe 100, more than 100 different combinations of what we did. When we got to the end, we all looked at each other and like, that's it. There wasn't even any question. As we were doing the final touches, we got there and it was, that's it. We know.
Collectors love your brand. What are kind of the holy grail expressions barrel?
Well, the answer to that question is, we look at the secondary market and we're excited that people are interested enough to pay more for a bottle in the secondary market than they pay it on the shelf. I find that the highest compliment. I think it's pretty amazing. And so everything that we do is a limited release. And once it's sold out, it's gone. Of the recent ones, 27 is a luscious.
And to describe to everybody out there, when you're throwing out these numbers, when you say 27, go ahead, tell them what you mean by that.
Yeah, 27 is our batch 27 bourbon. So we do about 4 of our batch releases per year, numbered sequentially. And there's no rhyme or reason to the age statement. It has to do with what we're trying to achieve with that particular bourbon at any given time. And so they're always a blend of different ages. And when you look at the age statement on our products, it's always the youngest one. But you can always be pretty sure that if it's a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old, 10-year-old, there's going to be 8, 9, 10, 12, 14, 16-year-old product in there. So that's one of the things that differentiate us. We are happy to use barrels that we have to complete the flavor or enhance whatever it is that we're doing with an older bourbon. May need some wood, may need some, some tannins, it may need some base. We'll do that. So I like any of the current releases. 27, I think, is notable for me. I go back to the old days of batch 5. To me, it was always this crazy, difficult one. Batch 8 is another really old favorite.
I'm writing this down, by the way, because I'm going to be like, do I have any of these? I want to go
take a look. 7. Seven was an interesting one because that was the first time we did a 5-year-old, and that won a number of awards. Batch 11 was the first one that we won San Francisco with. We've won that twice.
It's funny you talk about these things like they're your children, and and I guess they are in a way, right?
They are. Yeah.
Joe, Seagrass, very excited about this one. What do we got, about $90 a bottle on this thing?
Yes, that's the price point of the all the whiskeys and the bourbons are $90, except for the single barrels.
So again, Martinique rum, Madeira, and apricot brandy casks for this one. Harry Lennox, he loves his whiskey, but he is very discerning. And Harry gave this thing the thumbs up, as do I. But that's pretty much the case every time I have anything you do, man. Thank so don't get a big head, but I'm just don't get a big head. I don't want you.
I'm not. Every day we start over again. We prove ourselves every day.
Joe Beatrice, it's always great to see you, man. And I can't wait for the, I'm already looking forward to the next thing. And I think we might have something soon. I'm going to tease a little bit, a little teaser here. We might be seeing Joe again on this program soon because there is other big news, but I don't want to break it just yet. Joe will be back, and Joe will be back soon with something really special to talk about. And hopefully it'll be on this show that we talk about it first.
Happy to do that.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.